welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And it is Feedback Friday. Now, we have covered a lot of stuff. And it seems like I'm getting more and more questions, more and more desire to delve into conspiracies and conspiracy theories. And, so it all depends. See, that concept, conspiracy theories, means that there's multiple. And actually, there is multiple conspiracies because obviously, out of the clear blue, one corporation can conspire with another, or two people can easily create we'll call it a compact or an agreement to conspire. But when it comes to the overarching conspiracy of the world, you know, the grand conspiracy, there really is only one. And that conspiracy was identified and laid out, not laid out in heaven, but it was identified by our Creator, and even identified by Christ. They knew what would unfold. Now, a lot of people, when they look at this type of concepts and this kind of, you know, empirical data with the prophecies and everything else, it begs people to, you know, ask the question, do I really have a choice? I mean, am I being driven and completely manipulated? Or, you know, is there really free will? Because it seems like everything is just laying out and people are just going along with it. I'm here to tell you that it is about free will. And it's understanding the hearts of men that will, you know, basically, I'll just say, quickly gravitate towards doing either good or evil. And I just look at those of us who are here in these times that, we need to start discerning, you know, what is really happening. And what is really happening is the unfolding of the final pages of this grand conspiracy. You know, that seems like a real wild assertion, but like I've said before, and I will say again, I've read my share of conspiracy theories and conspiracy books, and I've read a lot of people's views. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I find interesting is the absence of a tie to the spiritual or the evil conspiracy, and the origins or the author of this conspiracy being Lucifer, Satan. And how it's all just laying out. And why is it that many authors refuse to actually create these ties to this? It's almost like, well, these are just men doing this. They're not doing the will of some fallen being who is here to undermine us and to try to get us to do evil and to do his will versus Christ's will. This really comes down to, because, and the reason why this is so important, folks, is when you read a book that does not bring this to, you know, into light, then I would ask you to question whether this person is a Christian, because to me, When we understand that there is this evil, the designer of evil, and this conspiracy, the architect of this conspiracy, that means that we have to acknowledge that Lucifer had fallen from heaven. Now, what religions actually embrace that? Well, it seems to be the Judeo-Christian religious, or the faiths that have kind of come from those cultures. You won't find this in Islam. You won't find this in Confucius. You won't find this in Hinduism, Buddhism, or what have you. In other words, they kind of just leave that stuff alone. And it's interesting that when you, like I said, when you read, because One of the best books academically that I really enjoyed reading, it was by Professor Epperson, A. Ralph Epperson, The Unseen Hand. But he doesn't really go into the spiritual context of this. And I'm here, so I'm going to give you kind of a real, let's just call this a special series on the Grand Conspiracy. It'll probably take maybe one or two episodes. We'll see how this all plays out. If it's less than an episode, I've got some need-to-know news that I pulled out a while ago from G. Edward Griffin's website, Need to Know News. And I've always spoken highly of this. If you really want to see some news that's out there that nobody else is reporting, or it's just like, you know, how come this isn't being reported? Well, he probably is reporting it. And another one, News Others Miss by Harry the Greek. Those are two websites that, you know, are talking about what's really currently going on. And I kind of wonder if Harry the Greek should actually meet A. Ralph Epperson, because I think the two of them, you know, should actually consolidate. You know what? I will see if I can facilitate that. But before I go on, the one feedback that I have gotten, because there's people that struggle with this Article 4 admittance into the Union, the concept that any state, any sovereign state, can actually apply to become a state in the Union. Now, there had been, and it was entertained after the Constitution was done, as people looked, and I forget, I don't want to quote or cite anything, but to my best that I can recollect, after the Constitution had been signed and under Washington's tutelage, under his guide and taking a pacifist, you know, role, I believe that there were emissaries, not necessarily his emissaries, but I believe that there were those who were actually seeking to grow the American empire, trying to build American empire, and had actually gone to what we'll call leaders, potential resistance leaders in Mexico and Canada, to see if they would be interested in becoming independent and joining the Union. And I believe this is an American patriot's view of, you know, of America, or a patriot's view of American history, something like that, by Alan and Swigert. And the reason I'm asking is because I was just recently asked last night about this. But the reason why initially there was this, you know, now we're not really interested by these, they weren't the formal government. This was not a formal, you know, emissary going down and saying, join us. This was more of like a, you know, a resistance effort. It may have been formal, but I don't recollect specifically. But it doesn't hurt my mind to think that there were good men in America that were trying to grow liberty. But both Canada and Mexico at that point in time, these people, not the governments, but these people that were approached, basically said, no, America has embraced slavery, and we don't want to have that in our future. And so it kind of moved forward. And as this went on, later on, when Mexico actually, you know, became an independent state, it was embracing slavery. Why? Because a lot of American slaveholders moved there and helped institute slavery in Mexico. Not that the Spaniards weren't already doing that, but in the northern reaches of Mexico, it was becoming more and more apparent that they were using slavery. And the emancipation of slavery ended in Mexico right around the same time. You know, the whole world came to this knowledge, we need to undo slavery, which was the 1850s, 1860s time frame, because clearly Russia emancipated their slaves and serfs, all 22 million of them, in the 1860s by the Tsar, which caused a huge economic crisis, that became the petri dish for communism and the global conspiracy to finally move forward. And so the question is, was that by manipulation and design, or was that just by circumstance? Well, let's get back to the conspiracy. Before I do, though, I just want to emphasize that if America is going to move forward, and this is my position, this is the Constitution's position, we should not be aiding and allowing a nation to maintain, you know, a form of government that is not fully embracing liberty and individual liberty and individual sovereignty. Now, America's got its problems, so we're not perfect, but if we were abiding by the Constitution, we would be. And, you know, if all things were right, we would actually be the chosen land or the chosen government for Israel to actually, you know, be able to be folded into and become a part of a land of liberty where Israel would be able to thrive. But that didn't happen thanks to the conspiracy, thanks to the late 1800s and the progressive era that unfolded because of all of this, because of all of the global manipulation. And here's the interesting thing. As we look at the term Illuminati, and as we really, you know, at a grand picture, macro view of the annals of history, the concept of the Illuminati, most people think, really began in 1776, when actually the term and the idea of organizing this illuminated philosophy, this illuminated society, really started in the 1400s, late 1400s, in the 15th century, at the end of the 15th century, by Spain. And the religious sect in Spain. Or a religious sect in Spain. You know, you got to really do the due diligence to go into it. And I don't care to write a book about the grand conspiracy. But when you start connecting the dots, there was obviously a religious faction, because what was happening in the Catholic Church, because this was strictly the Catholic Church at this point in time, and or factions within the Catholic Church. And so the 1400s, right? Martin Luther still hadn't broken away. And so this concept of the Illuminati in the end of the 1490s, or in that time frame in Spain, there's no doubt that this probably propagated throughout the ranks of the priesthood and the church and so forth. And so it stands to reason that as this concept moved forward, it got entrenched into the Germanic states. It got entrenched in everywhere where the Catholic Church had its control. And so when we start, you know, peeling the onion back and we see how the Protestant Reformation moved forward, there were a lot of people that were in that fold. I mean, 9 times out of 10, folks, when you have a society that breaks off, just like the American states, when they break off away from their motherland, that's not 100% of the people. It's a majority of the people that did that. So when we look at the migration of the Protestant faith away from the Catholic Church or the Reformation, there were those that were in the fold of the Protestant Reformation that were aware of and had started growing this philosophy of an illuminated society, the Illuminati. And so it took a couple centuries to kind of, you know, percolate and grow as we started recognizing, you know, the way forward and how could we have, you know, a better government. And in all honesty, the utopian society that was mapped out by Plato in his book, The Republic, clearly identified this statist government. Now, there's a lot of history involved in this utopian form of government. The Demarchia that I talked about before by Dante, when he wrote that, he was expelled not excommunicated completely, but he was banished from the Catholic Church for a while because he wrote a book that really spoke of those things in the scriptures that most people weren't supposed to know, that there needed to become an amalgamation, a joining of religion and government, to where religion would rule the world, because we had already gone away from, you know, that marriage, because it was already problematic when the Caesar of Rome made the Catholic Church his footstool, and he became the appointer of the popes. And so, in other words, the government and politics took over the church in the 300s. And so, as we kind of, as we watch all of this evolve, we can actually start seeing that, you know, there are those that aren't going along happily with this individual, you know, freedom, capitalism, and so forth. That the repugnant concept of industry and corporations and employing people to make things really started permeating. And as a matter of fact, there were those who felt that a noble monarch controlling things really, I mean, we even see some of the framers that actually felt that a noble monarch was the best form of government, but it was impossible to maintain. Because he had no guarantee between the onset of that noble monarch to when they die that it'll be maintained. The next person, because it's only been proven that it doesn't. Well, they've had noble monarchs in Britain, or so it seemed. But as we move forward, and actually I'll even stop here and actually peel back a little bit, because the manipulation and the design of manipulation by the church became really, really evident. And as we look at England and this concept of government, so we had this conspiracy of within religion itself. And in government, we already saw how things weren't going the way Britain wanted because of the establishment of the parliament. Now, we're not talking about the modern-day parliament, but we're talking about the establishment of the parliament as a precursor to the Magna Carta. The land barons, who really wanted the freedom and liberties of the people that they represented, as they basically addressed the crown, actually revolted and used their force with King John to say, look, you're going to guarantee our people these freedoms, because it was a group of true noble men. But when we look at, and the reason I'm going into this little spotlight on England and the Magna Carta was because John begrudgingly gave liberty to these people. And over time, I believe the plan was drawn out that England or Britain would actually manipulate this oligarchy of land barons and fold them into the monarchy. And in so doing, create a level of nobility and loyalty to the crown. Now, when we look at Parliament, there was this level of representation. But one of the things that was maintained was the sovereignty of the king. The king had the ultimate say. And over time, it ebbed and flowed, where the king would grant a little bit of power to Parliament to appease the people, to feel like they had, you know, some power. But when he, you know, got kind of fed up because either they were trying to encroach or they were hindering him or them, then, or because it could have been a queen, because they went back and forth. And so, as we see, and as we look at what ended up happening, is that they would, you know, pull back power and then they would get grant power as an appeasement. The framers were very well aware of that ebb and flow, and they were very well aware of the danger of the general powers being held by the crown or being held by government, regardless of whether it was a crown or whether it was a Continental Congress. They did not want to have central powers. They designed a system that was distributive, that granted all powers closest to the people. because the history of Britain taught them this. Now, as we watch what happens through the manipulation of the crown after the Magna Carta, we can actually start seeing the trend of manipulation under the British Empire. Now, the British Empire hadn't even risen yet, but they were already becoming very knowledgeable of the manipulations and how other empires functioned and worked. And I'm telling you, Britain was the most evil because they were the cruelest of all. I mean, the Pharaoh was pretty evil, and the Roman Empire, they were pretty evil. But the British Empire was just as equally evil, but they always tried to keep a smiley face on what they were doing. And so as we kind of move forward, and we already talked about Martin Luther and the breaking away, we can, you know, start seeing things percolating, these concepts of what would be better than having government doing these things, because you actually had a separation of factions. There was the altruistic utopians over here in religion saying, you know, we need to have something to where all people could be glorified. And they realized that because of the division of religion, now this happened over time, philosophy started stepping in, and the philosophy of man. So this all started evolving over time to where philosophy basically had to recognize that religion was really not necessarily the key player. Maybe it was a unique religion. Maybe it was a religion of man, not religion of a god. And I say this because they looked back to Plato and the statist and the state, and that the people were the sovereigns, stepping away from God being the ultimate sovereign. You got to remember that in the monarchies and the design, and if you read Locke's two treatises of government, you'll realize that the whole foundation of the monarchy was that the monarchs were appointed by God to govern. This was the perpetuated idea, which is why the Magna Carta was done the way it was, where King John couldn't. I mean, even the peasants and the land barons felt that the king himself was appointed by God. They've been taught this for years. It was accepted and common knowledge and fact. They didn't even challenge it. These concepts didn't even get challenged. And this is all a part of the Enlightenment era during Hobbes and then Locke in challenging, because Hobbes was a huge endorser of this, you know, this beautiful coronation of their king, you know, and this marriage between the church and state. Well, Locke actually broke through and actually started challenging. And I believe that this was truly the divine hand of providence in helping us start recognizing that we needed to start moving away from this marriage of church and state. And what was happening in the dark rooms of this evolving Illuminati was the concept of creating a godless state where the state itself became the religion. In other words, a direction of a new innovation of religion to basically create an entangled religious faith of man. Now, who does that sound like? I mean, who have we heard talk about, you know, a religion of man, the righteousness of man, humanism, Luciferianism? Those are the concepts of that. They've been around a long time, and as they evolve, they come in these little, principle, this little concept, and they start marrying these things together. And I'm telling you, folks, it's by design, and it's over time, because 9 times out of 10, people reject the sword at their throat. But if you basically have the sword out and then you slowly get it to where it's at the throat of the person, 9 times out of 10, the people don't even realize they've got the sword at their throat until it's too late. Or the boiling of the frog. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So actually, just to give you an insight of one of the reasons why I'm kind of putting all of this together is because there is a commonality. And as a matter of fact, back in the days of the early days of Israel and even prior, it has been always and it's interesting how Satan mimics what God does. It's not interesting. It's just these are known practices of how they get people to, you know, help people become obedient and loyal or what have you. And so if we look back in the really ancient days, like song is integral to religion. The lyrics and music are very integral because it's always been a part of our society and it's been a form of worship. Well, Satan wants to mimic that and use it for his own worship and getting people to, whether it be seemingly good. And I'll tell you, the Christmas hymns and those types of things, or Christmas songs, are basically a concoction that were created to get people to behave better in embracing a non-Christian doctrine of Christmas and basically folding it in or dovetailing it in with Christian doctrine, but it's not Christian. So anyway, like Santa, you know, what was the word for that? There's a word for those people, the pagans. Yeah, most of the Christmas traditions and so forth are pagan traditions that were folded into Christmas and getting people to start following and practicing paganism. But we'll get into that for the Christmas special because I dive strictly into Christmas at that point. So today, as we're kind of looking at the grand conspiracy, what really got me started was right after the invasion of Israel, or the attack, I should say, a couple of weeks now, the one song that kind of went through my head was the unofficial anthem of Britain, which is called Jerusalem. And if you understand the history of this song, it only just clicked in my head because I was already thinking about, you know, how certain things are integral in manipulation and how that song itself. So we'll get to that song later on. But the point is, as we start looking at how churches and religion of man started utilizing song for what was seemed like good purposes, there were also those who were doing the exact same thing under the perception that these were good things when really they were things to get us to, you know, like here comes Santa Claus or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. They might be appealing to kids, but they're paganistic. And they're being embraced as a part of Christianity. And I think everybody is starting to see this point, how there's this really evil overlap where there are probably some really good songs like when it comes to Christmas, I'll dive into that, because me and my memory on names and all of this stuff has just got too much junk up here in my head. Bottom line, as we started moving towards the Glorious Revolution, which was, you know, the end of the 17th century, mid-1600s, I think it was 1660s, something like that. Anyway, as the Glorious Revolution came out, it was literally another uprising, because the people recognized that the crown had gotten too far into folding in the land barons and everybody else, and now had basically co-opted control. And so the people demanded, you know, more liberties, and so they created the Glorious Bill of Rights, and then they started to demand more attention into Parliament, or more powers being delegated. But still, at that point in time, the king still possessed all the power. I mean, when we look at the American Revolution, Parliament was just, you know, a front for the king, and the king had the ultimate say. And when it came down to the treaties, who had to sign it? It wasn't Parliament that signed it. It was the king. And so when we look at how everything that was going on, the monarchy itself was still in control. The treaties with the Indians, the treaties, you know, going throughout the world, what they were doing in China, running drugs, that was all under the control of the monarchy. So what ends up happening when you've got a gang? Because this actually unfolds under our very own nose here in America, because organized crime and or people who try to go down, they maybe learn or they just stumble backwards into it. You know, they say, you know, let's create a gang and we're going to kind of take control, because there's a real lack of police or any type of control. And we're going to basically protect everybody. They're going to give us tribute, because that's usually how it happens. And in some cases, it may be because the people really need help. And then this legitimate need for a police organization act or this protection actually turns into a thuggery. You've heard me say, every time you create a mercenary system, in other words, some type of professional group of people, men, women, what have you, that you hire and pay to protect you, you've instantly created an institution and organization that is going to begin taking away, slowly but surely, they're going to start taking away your liberties and your rights. They're going to want to take away your weapons. They're going to want to have more power to control you. And eventually, this is the same thing that happens to government. And technically, a police organization, a police station, or what have you, establishing a local or municipal police force is literally just a armed force of enforcement of the law. And they eventually create, let's just call it, an incestuous relationship with your governors and what have you. And they actually start, next thing you know, you got sheriffs that become so political that they take over. They become the mayor, or they have that level of influence and control over the mayor. Folks, history just repeats itself and repeats itself. And so let's be honest, what ended up happening in creating the Illuminati in Spain? Well, Spain was a force that was ready to crumble, right? I mean, they had basically one century left, right? When we look at the Illuminati in the 1490s, when was Spain at this point in time was the empire of the world, kind of. They were the world dominators, right? And so when did they get knocked down a peg? And who did that to them? England. That's right. Because in the 1590s, I believe it was the Spanish Armada that was defeated by the English. And the English Empire began to rise at that point. And so as England had started its own plane manipulations and so forth, and I mean, they've been working, you know, in those green shires or what have you, they have concocted plans and so forth, so that when they came along and they saw some of these other organized crimes, there's no doubt in my mind that they went in and co-opted them. They basically went in and took over and integrated them into their hierarchy. Now, when we look at Revelations talks about crowns and crowns of the world, and that, you know, in the last days there would be like 13, or you have to count them all out, because I know that there's 10, and then there's three more, and then one that rules the three or what have you. And I'm not going to take the time at this point to go through the details. Please read Revelations, because it does talk about one crown basically sitting over all of the crowns. That crown is Britain, folks. There's no way around this. That crown is Britain. And so, because Britain is the last empire, and it is the last empire that actually has just recently started, even under the American Empire, the British Empire has thrived. When did they give up Hong Kong? When did they give up Israel? And so we'll get into this, but I don't want to jump ahead, because I want to, you know, get to this point of philosophy, because I was kind of touching on that. The concept of philosophy, of godlessness and so forth, really started thriving. And where was the hotbed of philosophy? It was in Europe. And actually, if we start looking, there were a lot of philosophers right there in Germany. Germany was the Germanic area was a very well-developed area, even though the French had their own, you know, affluence because of all the money and so forth. One of the things I learned, if you ever played, I think it was Stratego or what have you, you learn quickly that holding and controlling Europe is almost impossible. It actually is one of the very last places, you know, to dominate the world. It is one of the very last places that you can actually take control. It's easy to take control of Americas and the Asia and some of these places that are, you know, Australia, that are isolated in warfare and that type of strategy. But I believe the political and philosophical strategy, it's the same way. And so there, even though there was these contrasts in, I'll just say there were these direct contrasts in philosophy that were coming forward, I will tell you that there, since the beginning of time, there has always been basically two sides of philosophy. There is the side of full liberty, even though philosophy comes with these different shades and twists and everything else, and they dive into the nuances. There is a society that is based fully on liberty, and there is a society that is based fully on subjugation. These are the two opposing forces. And what happens is that we, as a people, we gravitate towards one, and we create these shades of gray. This is why I go through the scale of liberty from white to black. That once you start moving away from white, you start turning gray, darker gray, darker gray, darker gray, till you hit black. And these are just different degrees of control that the state has over you. Or in the old days, it was a theocracy. Anarchy, theocracy. But the bottom line, it really comes down to liberty and subjugation. So, as we kind of looked at the birth of the last and formal organization, the Illuminati was that organization that actually was established. The last final, the forming of the Illuminati for the final dispensation, the final era of mankind, was established, as I told you, in 1776 by Adam Weishaupt. Now, if you go to I believe it's the Encyclopedia Britannica, you'll actually find that they basically claim that the Illuminati was destroyed around the mid-1790s. In other words, they just disappeared. Folks, I'm telling you, they don't. And as a matter of fact, the way I can absolutely refute any assertion that the Illuminati was basically abandoned by all of these people who were seizing more and more power. I mean, look at what was going on in Britain. And what's really interesting is I don't think that Mr. Robinson, the gentleman that I have his book, it was written in 1798, and it's Conspiracies. I need to actually go there, because by doing that, then I can actually help you find it. It's on Constitutional Articles page. Hold on a quick second. Let me just look at this up. And I think it's just really important that I give you the title right. It's at the very bottom, though, of reclaimingtherepublic.org on the Constitutional Articles page. And so here we go. It is Proofs of a Conspiracy Against the Religions and Governments of Europe by John Robinson. And so as we move forward, as we kind of unpeel this one book actually proves that the conspiracy was still alive and moving forward. He was unraveling this. But this counters what they tried. I believe that this book has become so obscure that the academics and the intelligentsia of our society doesn't think that you have access to this book, so that you can actually see that the conspiracy was alive and well and moving forward at breakneck speed. And one of the ways I can actually prove this, because this all goes down to the manipulation of those who are seeking control. And I'm telling you that there became agents that actually understood what was happening, and that actually, because when we destroyed one and we destroyed another and we destroyed another, even thinking, oh, well, we're finally rid of this evil agency, like the Catholic Church. No, we're not. Look at the Catholic Church today. It's thriving, but it has no control over government. So it had to scuttle and move where, there was still a symbiotic relationship of coronations of government and religion. And when we come down to the final empire, because look at how Britain basically broke away from the Anglican Church. It wasn't by destruction. It was basically saying, we're going to do this on our own. And so it wasn't as forced upon as we saw with the Catholic Church and the Roman Empire, and nations kind of breaking away. Now, it wasn't that the Catholic Church still wasn't controlling these other nations, but eventually they started breaking their ties. And England was the first one to break their ties. And why was that? Because they wanted their own control over their own church, which put them on the path to becoming the world empire. Interesting, isn't it? And so when we start looking at the manipulation, it's really the manipulation regarding the will of people and getting them to choose to do these things. Now, I have said this before, if people really would have seen what the Fabian Society, the socialists and communists were actually bringing, the godlessness, the perversion, and the debauchery that they were bringing to the American soil, I'm confident that those people who were appealed to this new government philosophy and so forth, they would have tied these people up, to a rail. They would have tarred and feathered them and rode them out of town. They probably would have hanged them when they were done. Had they known how perverse and how evil these people really were. And so this was all exposed later in some of the journals of some of these founders of the Fabian Society that came to America. So anyway, as we start looking at the government manipulation around the world over a long time, we can see, again, Parliament becoming a big part of this. And Parliament has become the facade of democracy. The Crown still controls, and the Crown still receives, we'll call it tithes, because they do believe that they're holy. But it's tribute, and every part of the Commonwealth, from Canada, Australia, every part of the Commonwealth still pays tribute to the Crown, in addition to England. And so, as I kind of mentioned before, word and song have become really integral in this process. And the one song that really stood out to me that actually moved Britain towards this holy purpose was the song Jerusalem. Now, I have a little bit of time to do this, so what I'm going to do, because I'm going to actually try to play this in the background, if nobody's familiar with the song Jerusalem, actually you've heard it, you know, in different orchestrations, whether it be on a TV show or what have you. It is a religious appeal and song that has been basically ingrained into the hearts of the British Isle. From Irish, Scottish, all of them have basically bought into, I mean, begrudgingly on the Scottish and so forth, over, you know, initially. But today, they can all sing this song, and it becomes a very common song that they sing when they, you know, I don't want to call it a sobering moment because they may be in a drunken state, but they sing it with this deep, you know, religious affinity towards the Crown of Britain. Why? And so I'm going to get into the words of this song, but let me actually play the song and so you can actually hear it. And so this is an orchestration that was done by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And so you should actually be able to hear it. And so this, like I said, this is an orchestration that's done by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And this song was actually taken from a poem. And it talks about the history of the potential visit of Christ to Britain. And this poem makes this the Holy Lamb of God. And so this poem makes this bridge, establishing the principle that the New Jerusalem would be Britain. And so it's a powerful song. And as a matter of fact, it's a hymn. It's a hymn and an anthem. And so when you really listen, I'd invite you to listen to the whole song. And more importantly, I invite you to actually listen to the words. I'm going to read them for you so that you can actually hear these things. I'll play that way back in the background. And so this is the words to the song. And it says, "And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pasture seen? And did the continents divine shine upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among the dark satanic mills?" Now, this poem, I'll just stop right here. This poem speaks of these dark satanic mills because this was the beginning of the Industrial Age. And the Industrial Age was going to be vilified as the new form of enslavement, so that, you know, people would become subjects to a corporation instead of something more righteous like government. And so, among these dark satanic mills, bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental flight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. Now, I just want you to think about that. Just think about that. They're actually talking about, you know, using war and what have you to actually establish the new Jerusalem in England. Now, one has to think, because where was Jerusalem and who occupied Jerusalem at the time of this poem? It's easy. Britain and the British Empire was still occupying at this point in time. They were occupying, I believe, it was actually at the turn of the century when they really took over. But they had been playing with the, Crusades. And I think the Ottoman Empire, technically at this point in time, had their grasp on. But I believe Britain had basically moved in after the Ottoman Empire and basically subjugated Israel. And it wasn't until Israel. Now, at the same point in time, again, this was this anthem actually took a religious connotation and was really elevated to an anthem status, second only to God Save the King. And so, you know, folks, don't laugh. I just laughed. I laughed at the irony. But when we talk about government and we talk about Britain, the British people, and even the American pride of coming, those who have ancestors that came from Britain, you know, there's this beloved feeling of this holiness of England. And I'm here to tell you that that's not holiness. I believe that the Spirit of God has worked through all the people, and the people of Britain were equally important and integral in God's plan. But the government of Britain being the government of God, I'm sorry. And this whole manipulation, this whole creation of this religious government, the Anglican Church and so forth, you know, did not want to die. And it was still had not died in the early 1900s. As they took over Jerusalem, they prepared the way to establish, Israel. As they took over Israel, they took and made it possible for the Jews to be gathered. Now, let me see here. Let me get back to the song itself. Because again, like I tell you, for millennia, for thousands of years, song and word has been integral in helping people tune themselves religiously towards these ideas, these words, like I just read to you. And so as we look at Jerusalem as an unofficial anthem, and as it started growing, well, technically, the words were written at the beginning of the 1800s. When was the conspiracy being exposed? It was in the 1898 by John Robinson. And as we look at the establishment of this song, this was designed to change the hearts and minds of people to elevate Britain as their righteous church and kingdom. And so as things, again, kept on unfolding, post-World War, this concept, this song, because the words, actually the music, if I remember correctly, the music came in about 10 years later when the music, the original attempt of orchestrating it, and it has gone through a lot of different orchestrations. I happen to like the Emerson, Lake, and Palmer one, but bottom line, the orchestration started developing after 1817, 1819, something like that. So as this got elevated and basically became second to none other than the God Save the King, it really created a righteous paradigm of the British government. Now, we'll get back to the conspiracy next Friday. But I'm here to tell you that as we start unfolding and exposing more and more stuff, you'll see Britain in the center of all of this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.